Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
In 1999, the American Academy of Pediatrics issued its famous recommendation that children use no electronic screens before the age of 2. Back then, the screens they might have encountered were mostly just TVs and desktop computers, maybe not easy to avoid, but not impossible. Then in 2016 came an about-face. If screens were used for something like video chat with faraway relatives or for looking at photos, they could be a good thing for kids at any age. This new recommendation surely came as a relief to many parents, but it also made things more complicated. When is screen time good for kids? When and how much is bad? And how are we supposed to know the difference? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Anya Kamenetz covers digital education for NPR, and she's a parent just as concerned as the rest of us about getting this stuff right. So she decided to do a deep dive into what the science actually says about screen time at different ages. Does it help with learning and relationships, or could it harm concentration and lead to social isolation? The answer to all those questions, yes. Her new book is called The Art of Screen Time, How Your Family Can Balance Digital Media and Real Life. And Anya Kamenetz joins us this hour from the studios of NPR in New York. Anya, welcome back to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Nice to be back.
I want to start with this. There was a time when parents were warned about the dangers of movies and radio and TV for the healthy development of children. There's no question that those once new forms of media changed what it meant to be a kid. Is there something different about mobile technology?
Well, yes and no. So as you mentioned, you know, there's a history of ways that we as a culture react to these new technologies coming in. It always does seem that the kids have even more of an affinity for new tech than even adults do. What's different this time? I mean, the ubiquity, right? The mobile devices, they're coming with us everywhere. And the handheld devices with the touch screen technology do seem to be incredibly intuitive even for young infants. And that's something that is giving a lot of parents pause.
So you remind us that there are two ways to look at the impact of screens, right? One is that no safe level of exposure for children has been established. It's all potentially toxic. The other is to look at it a little bit like food. It's over the top to imagine that a small amount of even junk media is likely to cause real harm, but the job of parents is to help people understand the difference.
That's exactly right. So we are tasked as parents to kind of give this healthy balance to our kids and communicate what that looks like. And we don't necessarily have, you know, all the information, a full nutritional breakdown, if you will, to go on with this. But I talk about it in that way because I do think that, you know, it's overblown to think that, except in very special cases, that there really is such a thing as toxic effects from media.
And there are, you know, among the children of America, there are what you call dandelions and then there are orchids. What do those terms mean?
So this is a theory that's been put forth by social scientists who study media effects to explain a puzzling reality, which is that although we see that media is everywhere, we can tell that it can have profound effects, and yet the effects that we've investigated tend to be pretty small. And so the theory that's come forth is that most of our kids in this digital media-rich environment are like dandelions. They're pretty resilient to what they're taking in. And a small percentage, however, may be more sensitive. They may be like orchids, and they may be particularly drawn to that kind of media, and that media might also not be the most beneficial for their development.
So how do we know if we have an orchid?
Well, the fact is that you can pragmatically observe your kid and see some pretty clear red flags. And so, you know, what I talk about in the book, I talk about the biggest, most well-defined effects from media have to do with sleep and obesity. So we see that when kids use screens late at night, when they use them past their bedtime, it really interferes with sleep. And we see that large amounts of screen time over 2 hours a day can increase the risk of obesity. But putting those two, and those are big categories aside, when your kid seems to have a problematic relationship to their screen media, so when it seems to be the only thing they prefer to do, their most preferred activity, the only thing that helps when they have a bad day, if you see them being explosive when it's turned off and they get angry, if they're sneaking around to use it, those are some of the red flags to tell you that your kid might be one of those orchids.
What's so interesting is that scientists think they understand why screens make it harder to sleep even after we turn them off, because they emit this kind of blue light that makes our brains think it's early morning. They're not quite as clear as to why screens are related to obesity. It seems like that's obvious, too.
Yes, Chris, I found this so interesting and a great example of the complexity of this research. Scientists have not been able to corroborate the couch potato theory, right? The obvious assumption would be that kids who watch more TV are moving their bodies less. And rather than being able to corroborate that, they are looking at the idea that kids are susceptible to the very unhealthy advertising messages on a lot of kids' media, as well as mindless eating while watching. So the notion there is that when you are watching TV and you're snacking while you're watching, you're not tuning into satiety cues and your actual natural appetite. So it's a lot more complicated than, you know, might seem from our intuition.
I was really surprised to learn there is so little definitive research on any of this. And part of the problem, you note, is that researchers can't assign like a subgroup of babies to watch TV for 3 hours a day or play on iPhones. It's not ethical.
Yes, right. So we don't have the gold standard randomized controlled trial evidence that we would like to have. And in the cases that we do, it's quite old. So, for example, violence in the media is something that's been investigated for decades. And back in the 1960s, there were these trials where they showed kids a video of a Bobo the clown, this inflatable clown being beaten up. And then they would go out, the kids would go out, and in many cases, they themselves would also hit an inflatable Bobo the clown given the chance to do so. So we have some of these old trials. But then when you're asking questions from today about, you know, kids with attention disorders or kids with emotional issues, we're not having those kinds of investigations because they just would never go by an ethics board today.
Hmm. What happened when researchers tried to ask parents to limit the amount of screen time their kids had?
Right. So you would think you could study it this way, right? Get the parents to turn the TV off and then investigate the effects on the kids. Dimitri Christakis from the American Academy of Pediatrics, who tried to do such a trial, said it just didn't work. The parents ended up reducing screen time by about 20 minutes per week, and it just wasn't enough to make a difference that could be investigated in a scientific way.
It's easy to feel all judgy and say, well, don't these people have any control over their kids? Do we know why parents found it so hard to cut that time back?
I mean, I surveyed over 500 parents to talk about what they do at home with screens, and I think it's really important to recognize, and I try to do so in the book, that parents are in a lot of different kinds of circumstances. It's never been harder to raise kids in the United States when you think about the demands on people as far as work, two working parents, long commutes, and parents themselves are often bringing home work as well. And so technology is one of those things, as one mom told me, you know, it seems so benign. The kid is safe, they're at home, they're sitting there hour after hour, and you just don't notice. And so I really do think there's an awareness gap in terms of what the kinds of media that we grew up with and then the effects we might be seeing with media with kids today.
The way we talk about screens is, you know, the TV is passive and something that happens on a smart screen or a computer is supposed to be interactive. Is there a functional difference in the way they engage the brain?
It's so interesting. The answer to that is yes, but doctors think differently about the benefits and drawbacks of those two categories. So, you know, some doctors say that they prefer the interactive, that you can learn from a good interactive app and it's engaging your mind a little bit more. And other doctors who are concerned about, you know, the compulsive relationship with media, you see that a lot more with games than you do with television. And so with kids who might have, you know, problematic relationships with media, it shows up more often in that interactive category than it does with just watching videos. So it's interesting to see that, like, some parents might think, well, if it's an app and a game, it's good. If it's TV, it's bad. And doctors aren't so sure about that.
What makes us keep going back for more after we've played a game we liked or checked in once on social media?
Oh, my God, that's such a huge question. And people usually answer that with regards to dopamine, which is, you know, a chemical that's released in the brain when you're seeking a reward. The simplest way that I've found to explain it is that whether it's social media or video games, they're both designed on the same principles as slot machines, which is to say that you are offered the chance to get something great. And every once in a while, you get something really great, like great news from a friend or, you know, a reward in the game. But you never know when that's coming. And so you're tied to it by this schedule of intermittent reinforcement. And you just want to keep going back. And then bing, every once in a while, you get that great thing. And that is something that our brains are just so primed for. And, you know, developing brains, especially teenagers developing brains, they're even more primed for seeking rewards. So you see, you know, the reason that, like, teenagers tend to be risk takers, for example, and they tend to be very tuned into what their peers are doing, they have this openness to seeking rewards. And that's something that often locks in with exactly what these platform makers policymakers are creating for them.
And because, of course, those rewards are artificial, so are the limitations placed on them. So in this, like, you could love to play tennis, but at some point you get too tired and hungry to keep playing. You might like shopping, but you run out of money. With a video game, as long as you're willing to play, they're open for business.
That's a great point. Exactly. And the 24-hour schedule, both for games and for social media, is a really big problem because, you know, especially with social media, you find, you know, it's access to peers, which is exactly what teenagers love and want and wish for. But it's 24/7 access to peers. So, for example, where, you know, when you and I were in high school, we might have been performing all day for like an imaginary audience of our friends at school, after school. But eventually you go home, you go to bed, and you can be on the phone, but you can't necessarily have that access. And now we see that kids are bringing their devices into their bedrooms, and they are literally all night long sometimes responding to notifications. And there's always a chance to be seen by someone or have someone see you, see you, you're seeing them. And that's something that's just so attractive to a lot of teenagers that get in over their heads.
How real is the threat of addiction? I've heard a lot of debate over how we should think about people who use this technology compulsively.
Great question. So the medical profession, the jury's out right now in the United States. The DSM, the Bible of the psychiatric profession, does not use the term addiction in regards to internet use, either for youth or for adults. However, the World Health Organization has moved toward something called gaming disorder, so particularly with regards to video games. Despite the fact that there's not that classification, and doctors are really divided on using that term, there are treatment programs, and there are starting to be kind of protocols and better understanding of, you know, some of the criteria I talked about earlier in terms of red flags. So parents, you know, should be watching to see if their kid has a problematic relationship with media in particular. But, you know, one of the clinicians I talked to, he runs summer camps called Summerland, for kids with problematic relationships, what he calls it, or digital overuse. And he says, you know, I prefer to conceptualize it as a habit rather than an addiction because it's a lot more empowering for teens. And, you know, teens are, they're forming their identities. And if you slap them with a label like addict, it can be very, you know, it has a big influence on how they're constructing their identities. And it might be dangerous in and of itself.
Is there a social consequence for teenagers whose parents say you will absolutely not have a smartphone?
That's a really great question. I think that just like with any child-rearing decision that goes against the grain socially, you know, a parent might feel very strongly about it, and a kid, there's a couple of different things that might happen. A kid may grow up to thank you. They may rebel. They may sneak around and quietly rebel. And that's like the possible range of responses, right? So there's no law against raising your kid in a cabin in the woods without electricity, and there's no law against raising your kid without a smartphone. But in terms of, you know, how far are you going from the norm of, you know, teenage life, and what kind of price might you have to pay? You know, I think that's something that families really need to consider for themselves. I would say there's some kids who are, you know, their therapists believe that they need treatment and they need detox. And then even when they go home, they need to have a flip phone because it's that problematic for them to have 24/7 access. So it really is a case by case. I'm not in a position to tell any parent what to do.
Well, this is much more complicated than what I was hoping you would be able to tell us. And it's because every family has to make these decisions based on the kid the universe gave them and the situation they're in.
Well, that's so true of any parenting topic, you know, and particularly in this area where it is such a gray area, the research frontiers are really just, they're kind of a step behind the demand in terms of what parents want to know.
All right. My guest is Anya Kamenetz. She's an education blogger for NPR and author of a new book called The Art of Screen Time, How Your Family Can Balance Digital Media and Real Life. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in with at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send your question via Twitter. We are @KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Anya Kamenetz, who writes about education for NPR. Her new book is called The Art of Screen Time, How Your Family Can Balance Digital Media and Real Life. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Okay, I want to go back to the olden days, Anya, and talk about the quaint medium of television. I was raising young children during the era of the no TV before age two thing. And I distinctly remember one Saturday, my son was asleep in his little swing and we were in the living room and I was folding laundry. So I put on like a Golden Girls rerun at low volume. And I looked over after a few minutes and not only was he awake, but he was mesmerized on this thing. And I remember knowing about the fact that he wasn't supposed to watch TV and worrying about that. But the funny thing is, he was a kid who was always obsessed with a screen. And my daughter, who came along a couple of years later, didn't care. Where did the research come from that caused the American Academy of Pediatrics to decide that no one should have TV before age two?
I'll quote Dr. Victor Strasburger, one of the co-authors of that rule, who said, "There was no evidence, none. We made it up, and we caught holy hell for it."
Wow.
Yeah, before going on to say that later studies, especially the baby Einstein studies, which became kind of famous, did show potentially some language delays with lots of exposure for infants. But it's just it's a reminder of the state of the research and the fact that pediatricians are being pushed to make expert recommendations, but not with all the evidence that we would like to have.
So why did they, when they changed it, did they decide that, in fact, it wasn't quite so bad?
Well, again, when they changed it, they sort of they adopted what Dr. Christakis, Dimitri Christakis, called to me a harm reduction philosophy, in the sense that 9 out of 10 families were showing their kids some television before the age of two, and they needed a better message because the one that was out there, most families weren't following it. And so how they arrived at this recommendation to say, you know, video chat's probably okay. They don't have an affirmative study that shows video chat's okay. They don't cite it. If you look at the guidelines, they're not citing any affirmative studies. All they're saying is, we see a lot of video chat happening with babies. There's some sense with toddlers, perhaps they can have a conversation with video chat, actually learn something the way that they would in a live conversation. And so it's probably okay. But I mean, this should not, you know, strike a lot of calm into the hearts of parents who are hoping that there's going to be some expert voice telling us exactly what to do here.
If there's agreement from almost all corners, it's that something called parental mediation is useful. And I gather this is just a fancy way of saying watch with them, sometimes go online with them, make it a social experience.
That's exactly right. So whether your child is a toddler or a teenager, some of the time that they're consuming media, it needs to be not solo. It needs to be with you, whether they're as a young child, you know, talking about what's on the screen, pointing things out, naming things. Oh, that's a cat, like our cat. As kids get older, you know, of course, you can progress to discussing themes, talk about, you know, what you do and don't like about Disney princesses, for example, open up that conversation. And as kids get older and they're pursuing more of their own interests online, you know, oftentimes the conversation becomes very much about limiting and monitoring, but we can also have a positive current of conversation to say, hey, let me know what you're into. I'm curious about the latest app. Even if you're not, you should be curious because your teens are out there. They're doing stuff and it's stuff that they love and you have a chance to learn and get something from it and figure out a little bit more about what they're doing.
What can parents do as kids get older to mitigate the effects of accidental exposure to stuff we agree is sort of universally, if not harmful, certainly objectionable, things like violent content or pornography?
Great question. So there is a study by Dr. Eric Rasmussen at Texas Tech who talked about kids who had conversations with their parents about pornography specifically when they were sharing their own values as a family. When those kids, so they remembered these conversations, their early teenage years, something took place, you know, a talk. Those teens, when they got on into college and they were in relationships, and those relationships might have involved someone who used pornography, they had an easier time. They didn't feel so much harm to their self-esteem. They had a better understanding of kind of like where this falls in the world. And so sharing your values, talking to your kids, even though it may be awkward and you may not know the right time to do it, it's worth kind of having that conversation and helping them really understand it a little bit better. Because, you know, what's happening today is that our kids, sex ed in schools is not always adequate, and they're turning to pornography with real questions.
Oh, dear.
And, Yeah, that's a seriously sad reality, and it's part of a bigger conversation about schools and the resources that we do and don't have for public service. So, yeah, we need to be there as parents, because that's a conversation you really don't want them to be having one way.
All right. Since you mentioned schools, I want to talk about using computers for learning. Even if parents have really strict rules at home, kids are going to encounter these technologies at school. I was stunned when my daughter in sixth grade came home and said, the teacher said we should all have smartphones because we're going to turn in assignments this way. That seemed really young to me, but it seemed maybe this was just part of her case for getting a smartphone at that age. But schools realize kids are using these, and they're trying to at least, meet them halfway.
Yes. Yeah, so one-to-one programs where, one child, one device have become pretty prevalent across the country and across the world. And that's in advance of any proof of, great learning gains just from the fact of having digital devices in the classroom. They're not a magic bullet by any means. And they bring with them, really both good opportunities and some bad results in the classroom. And, it's for parents, again, what I'm hearing most often is that they don't understand the purpose for which the tech is being brought in. And they really need to have that conversation because, kids, a lot of the times they're coming home with devices. Homework is turning into this multitasking event that's lasting several hours because they're listening to music and chatting with their friends. And it's much harder to concentrate when they're doing, when math is just one browser tab of 20.
Right.
So figuring out how to help kids focus is something that parents need to be proactive on. They have to be talking to teachers as well about what are the expectations here and can we figure out a way to make a balance for everyone.
All right, let's go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Marty is calling from Austin. Hi, Marty.
Hi, I'm glad you mentioned teachers. I actually left a teaching career partly because of the problems with cell phones. How can we use them? How can we control them? What are we doing with cell phones in schools to help teachers instead of just making it more complicated for us?
That's a great question. So, we can't have successful adoption of technology without good professional development. And, and I think some schools and some initiatives are starting to realize this. I've seen teachers using social media in a great way amongst themselves to share best practices. And one of the examples actually is a story I published recently on NPR about laptops and phones in the classroom. Some teachers ban them entirely. Other teachers try to take advantage of them and say, if the kids are, if we're doing active learning, if we're doing group project-based learning, and if we give the kids a task, like you mentioned, Chris, a task to do in class on their smartphones, there's less of a chance that they're going to be getting distracted. But, there's a gamut of responses there, and I think teachers really need to be conferring with each other to figure this out because, there's similar challenges almost everywhere you look.
So we're going to talk in a minute about the kinds of strategies that different parents use in order to set limits for their kids. What does it take to help a child develop self-control? Because it's one thing to sort of take a device away or limit the times, but it's another thing to raise a kid who knows when he or she has had enough.
That's right. And that goes directly to general parenting theory, right? So the framework for parental mediation of media that I talk about in the book is based on Diana Bomrin's parents. There's two dimensions of parenting, essentially. There's warmth and there's structure. And so when you have a parent who just says, what I say goes, no screens ever, that is like an authoritarian style of parenting, right? And it leads to rebellion. It leads to hiding. It leads to doing stuff at a friend's house. And then you have parents on the opposite end of the spectrum who are just like, hey, honey, whatever you want to do is fine. There's no rules in our house. And that can lead to overuse problems. It can lead to, all of the negative effects that we talk about with overuse. And then, the parents who are warm yet structured, who say, there's a time and a place for this. I'm not condemning what you like to do on the media, but I also want us to have our time as a family, and this is part of our values. It's important for us to strike a balance. That's kind of what you want to be. That's a sweet spot.
Okay, so real families that you spoke to wanted to limit screen time in some way, and their options are to do it by time, by occasion, by priorities, or by content. Can you talk about each one of those?
Absolutely. And most families use a combination of these. But so obviously screen time is in the title of the book. It's one of the most common strategies. Most of the survey people that I surveyed said they let the kids use about an hour a day. Obviously, that's way far from the surveyed average, which is higher than that. But, you know, time is straightforward. It's easy to understand. It's harder to enforce as your kids get older. And so priority and occasion. Occasion simply means, you know, we use screens on Saturdays. That's what we do at our house. We use screens on Saturdays or when we're traveling or vacation. Those are the times that, like, anything goes. A priority is a little bit different. On a day-to-day basis, you might say, well, as long as your homework's done, as long as you've played outside, as long as we've had a face-to-face conversation about your day, then you can go and use the screens. The content version is kind of what we were talking about before, is to say, you know, there's stuff that I like you using, and you can maybe, you know, if it's educational, you're permitted it. And then if it's what I consider to be junk, then you get a little bit less of that or maybe none of it. So, you know, most parents find themselves using a mix of these strategies and adapting as the kids get older, and different levels of control seem more or less appropriate.
Not so useful strategies are centered around convenience or emotion.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, this is just really tricky, right? With most things that you might want to set limits on at home, like bedtime, for example, that's a benefit to you, the parent, right? It's good when your kid goes to bed on time because it's good for you. But with TV or with media, we find ourselves handing it over when it's convenient for us, right? When we need to get ready, when we need to make dinner, the screens are always beckoning. And so it's so hard to hold the line there because kids don't understand why your answer is always changing. Sometimes it's yes, sometimes it's no. And that makes it really hard to have a good level of control without conflict. And then governing by emotion is so interesting. So a lot of parents kind of have a gut feeling when their kid's been on it too long. And that's a documented thing. Kids, there's an explosive reaction that can happen when kids are too tied into screens, or they've been binging, if you will. They can get very upset, very angry. But the problem is then you're in this position of just when the kid is in their worst mood, that's when you're pulling the plug. And obviously that leads to predictable blowups.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Anya Kamenetz. She writes about digital education for NPR, and she's author of a new book called The Art of Screen Time, How Your Family Can Balance Digital Media and Real Life. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372. All right, let's go back to the phones now. We have Jorgen on the line in Plano. Hi, Jorgen.
Hi. Hey again. My question is, what's the best way time for kids?
The best, I'm sorry?
Adults. My question is, what's the best way to limit time on screens on phones for kids and adults?
All right, thanks for your call.
Great question. So in terms of approaches to limiting screen time, I mean, I start with bedtime. I start with not wanting to have screens in the bedroom or as part of the bedtime routine, maybe even like more than an hour or two before bedtime. A lot of parents have success with having weekends only, or maybe Friday, Saturday, Sunday. If you're looking for technical fixes, a lot of parents report success with an app called Unglue that works on the mobile phone. There's also apps that I talk about in the book called Moment, and there's one called Freedom. And they all have different kinds of features, so whether you're looking to limit time overall or block specific apps or sites.
It's interesting that he also asked about adults, because our kids are learning a lot about how these things are supposed to be used by observing the way we use them.
Oh, that's so true. And I spend a lot of time in the book talking about parents and screens. I surveyed over 500 families. Less than 3% told me that they strictly limit their own screen time around their kids. So a lot of us feel like we're picking up our phone maybe too much of the time when we're with our own kids. And that is very powerful. Our kids are seeing us. They don't know exactly what we're doing on the phone. It's a little bit mysterious to them. We're conducting some kind of adult business. But what they do know is that we may be interrupting conversations. We may not be listening as well as they'd hope us to be listening. And it's something I think, you know I can do better on, and I think a lot of parents feel that they could do better on.
There are interesting issues here for people raising kids who have an autism spectrum disorder. In some cases, kids who are really worn out from interactions with a lot of other people can decompress a little bit with a screen. And it sounds like the experts are really divided over whether this is a good or a bad thing.
I found this to be so fascinating. That's very true. So we know the kids on the spectrum are more drawn to media. That seems to be true across the board. But whereas some doctors see this as something that might be interfering with the kind of social learning that they need to be doing in order to, you know, build more skills, other family members, parents, and other advocates for people with autism believe that it's more like an accommodation. It's something that can help some kids with specific issues that they have, or just being a way to relax. You know, I think it's kind of a microcosm of the whole debate over screens, which is to say that just because you love something or you're very, very excited about something, it doesn't mean that's in itself a problem. You have to look at it in the broader context of what are these people's goals? What are your short-term goals? What are your long-term goals for you and for your kids?
All right, let's go back to the phones and speak this time with Sam in San Antonio. Hello, Sam.
Hi. I wanted to say that I'm a 18-year-old that just graduated high school. And my parents use social media more than I do. And so it's drawn me to kind of step away from social media because I can see how my parents, like, dissociate sometimes. Hmm. And it's taught me to, like, you know, stop using it more than I usually used to.
Have you told them that it bothers you, Sam?
Well, it would be at the dinner table, and they would be on their phones, like, after we finished eating. And I would make a comment about it, like let's do something, you know. But, They usually don't change, you know. Because they're the parent, they usually don't take those kind of comments, you know, from their children and, like, let it make an impact on them.
Yeah, thank you very much for your call. What about that, Anya, that parents can be distracted by their phones and not paying attention to their kids?
I hope other parents are listening to Sam, because I know from surveys that a lot of kids feel the same way, and that it's a subtle thing that may be draining our energy and our efforts to focus on each other, even in the limited time that we have together.
And it's really easy to assume that you're all in the same room, so you're together, but it's also easy not to be fully present even with when you're sitting with your child.
Well, that's exactly right. So, you know, it's complicated, right? Because there's an implicit child-rearing philosophy with young kids that we're supposed to be focusing on them right now, 24/7. That's kind of 21st century conventional wisdom. And I don't necessarily think that's true. I think kids should be able to play on their own and take risks. That said, you know, our kids need our attention when we're focusing on them. And it's something, again, that I feel that a lot of parents could do better on.
Anya Kamenetz is my guest. She covers digital education for NPR and is author of a new book called The Art of Screen Time, How Your Family Can Balance Digital Media and Real Life. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Email think at kera.org or find us on Twitter. We're at KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with NPR education blogger Anya Kamenetz, whose new book is called The Art of Screen Time, How Your Family Can Balance Digital Media and Real Life. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. All right, Anya, let's get real here. There are lots of adults walking around today raising kids who watched a lot of TV themselves as kids. You write that you were one of those. I'll admit that I was one of those. is there a lot of statistical difference between adults who were heavy screen consumers as children and those who didn't have as much access?
That longitudinal data, it just isn't there.
Wow. Wow.
I can tell you. I know you would think that we'd be able to find it. Now, you know, in terms of the, like I said, the best founded research is about sleep and obesity. And if people who have, you know, long, heavy screen time habits, you know, you might expect to see impacts in one of those two areas. But, you know, the fact is that we don't have the same pathologization of television watching that we do seem to have with the smartphone very quickly. And maybe that's because the phone is new and the TV is old. But, you know, people talk about binge watching like it's just a very cool thing to do and right. Not like actually a scary thing to do.
Maybe that's just because we're more familiar with it.
I mean, maybe so. And I remember at the dawn of the participatory internet and social media, people like Clay Shirky talking about, gosh, you know, 35 hours a week, people are sinking into television watching. Imagine if they were being creative with that time. And it turns out instead of being creative, we decided to start tweeting instead. But we're still watching 35 hours a week of television. And it's kind of amazing. I don't know how people fit it all in, honestly.
Well, because they're doing two things or three things at once.
That's exactly right. And yeah. Right. So the leisure to actually watch a television show and do nothing else. Oddly enough, you now see family physicians and psychiatrists talk about the beauty of the family movie night. Right. Everybody put their small devices down and actually watch something together. What a novelty, which I find to be. I mean, that's great. We tried it actually last week and it was great with my older daughter. But, you know, it's funny that you'd actually be nostalgic for something that just used to be par for the course.
Did you get any good advice on when, as a parent, you should step back with the realization that your kids will be fully on their own at some point in the near future?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, it's so hard for parents today. And I think we have a paradigm of kind of helicoptering them even into the workforce sometimes. Yeah. But, you know, laying down the law gets less and less effective as kids get older. And you really want to work on getting their buy-in and helping them scaffold, right, their own regulation, their own self-regulation. So ideally, that's a conversation that starts when they're young. I mean, when my daughter had, you know, she has an explosive reaction sometimes to if we let her watch too long. And I talk to her about it and say, hey, you know, if we can't manage this emotion, then let's think about strategies. Should we be taking more breaks? You know, do we need to have something to look forward to when you're done with the screen time? And that's been helpful for us. So I think you can't start too young, honestly, giving kids control over their own time and the ability to think through their own priorities.
All right. Back to the phones now. We have Tyler calling from Houston. Hi, Tyler.
Hi there.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
So I've just had my first child, and so I was very interested when you start talking because I'm naturally a little freaked out about raising a kid and the media culture that we have now. But my wife and I have been talking a lot about how we ration media for our kids, and my mom had a really interesting way when I was growing up of she would give us all a certain number of poker chips at the beginning of the week, and they were each worth a certain number of minutes. You know, you got a white one for 15 minutes and a blue one for 30 minutes or whatever. And we kind of had like a media allowance, and I thought it was, you know, as we've been talking about, I thought it was a really great way to handle it because not only did it teach us how to budget our time, but, you know, when time was up, we weren't mad at mom. It was just, you know, time was up. And so that was just a little brag on my mom, but also wanted to just kind of get y'all's opinion on budgeting and rationing in that kind of way.
Well, thanks very much for your call, Tyler. What's really interesting about that to me, Anya, is that it also requires the child to like not waste your 15 minutes of TV time on something that you're not that interested in.
I think this is a great approach. And I do talk in the book about parents that use chips or passes or a calendar and, you know, or trade TV time for reading time. So I think that, you know, it sounds like a great thing that's worth looking at, especially when you think about, like, right, the intentionality of how we're going to use our time and helping kids think through that as young as possible can be great. Another dad that called in to another show that I was on talked about they give their kids one charge per week on the iPad. So they have the power cord and they get one charge and it's to use as they see fit. And what's great about that is, of course, you know, video streaming and game playing takes up more battery space than reading. So there's a neat little nudge there, too. But, anything that you could do and almost make it a playful thing, not necessarily a power struggle, I think is an interesting approach to explore.
Did you happen to talk to anybody about what they do when eating out? When my kids were younger, it used to make me crazy that you couldn't. There were a lot of family-oriented restaurants that just cover the walls with television screens, and we don't watch screens while we eat.
This is so interesting, right? Because what's happening now is the controversy over the parents at a restaurant and the kids are plugged into their own devices at the restaurant. And for some parents, you know, that's their approach. Instead of getting a sitter, they took the kid out, but they're not necessarily engaging with the kid. And it drives some people crazy and other people think it's totally normal. And I actually have friends who are, you know, she's a teacher and she's very into child development. And this is the only tablet time they give their son is when they're out and about. So, yeah, I mean, it's a little bit strange, but it just kind of points out the idea that we're not in control of our kids' environment all the time, and your control wanes as the kid gets older, and so you need to figure out an approach that really is flexible and pragmatic.
All right, back to the phones. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Javier is calling us from San Antonio. Hi, Javier.
Hi, hello.
Yes, I wanted to follow up on the previous caller, Sam, who was struggling with his parents using too much screen time.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, are there any strategies for limiting screen times with somebody who you don't have any authority over, be it a spouse, a partner, or even just a peer?
That's a great question. I mean, it really gets to the social contract, right? Instead of trying to have, you can't have control over someone, but you can talk together about what are your shared values, your shared goals for the relationship. When you do this, I feel this way. And when, you know, when this happens, I think this. And could we try something together? The app moment that I talk about in the book was actually started by a developer. And he was in a friendly competition with his fiance, and she used her phone way more than he did his. But they both set goals together to limit their use. And they both actually halved their daily use when they first started using the Moment app. So, you know, not to be a commercial for that app, but the idea that, you know, it can be a shared negotiation and say, you know, I noticed these things. It's having an impact on our relationship. And can we please try to do something a little different? I hope, you know, I'd hope that most people would be open to that.
It is something that is part of every adult relationship now that didn't used to be a thing.
That's exactly right. And, you know, we all have different approaches to it. And I think also, you know, through no fault of our own, right? It's something, the phone is something that we default to. We pick up either out of sense of urgency, maybe something going on at work, or just because our minds are drifting. And instead of having that boredom or that blank moment, the phone is what we reach for. So one thing that I adopted around my kids, but I think it helps actually in other social situations, is when I pick up my phone, I state the reason. So whether that be, you know, I want to check my, I just need to check my email to see if this came through, or I want to check the weather. It forces me myself to think about the intention and not just drift off to, you know, oh, scrolling through my Pinterest feed. And it also helps my communication partner, my conversation partner, to understand why is it that I'm doing this at this moment.
Just to understand the Moment app, by the way, to go back to that, if I understand it correctly, all it really does is just keep track. So it'll say you were on Facebook for 3.5 hours last week and you were on Pinterest for 2 hours, that sort of thing.
It does that. It also has a feature that you can basically make the phone hard to access for certain amounts of time. You have to unlock it or do an annoying thing to get to the phone, which a lot of other apps are doing. So there's one called Flipped that I talked about for use in classrooms that, again, if you put it on during certain times, you have to solve a code or put something in to use the phone. So it's just that gateway that actually stops you from using the phone at certain times. So Moment has a feature called Family Dinner Time, which can be set at any time by any one of the phones that's shared on the app. And so potentially like a kid like Sam could say, like, this is family dinner and everybody should be off their phones and I'm going to enforce that.
All right. Let's speak next with Hay calling from Dallas. Hello, Hay.
Hi. Yes. I was wondering, is there any consensus among the medical community when our children should start using their smartphones to communicate via Snapchat or Instagram, anything along those lines?
There isn't a medical consensus. Most of those services that you name, they have a minimum age of 13, and that's because of federal law. You know, regardless, I do think that it's sort of a case-by-case basis with your kid. You know, if you have a kid who's good at generally setting limits, if they're good with dessert, if they're good with, you know, other kinds of treats, it might be something that you can introduce. And with other kids, you might want to be a lot more cautious and have a lot more guardrails up, at least at first.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is NPR education writer Anya Kamenetz, whose book is The Art of Screen Time, How Your Family Can Balance Digital Media and Real Life. Did you meet anybody, Anya, who told you with a straight face, I'm really not worried about this and I'm just sort of letting my kids do what they want?
Well, no. I mean, by the nature of this book, I talked to people that were concerned about it. But I think that, you know, most people feel like it's part of being a conscientious parent today. You have to have some kind of policy. The thing that I thought was a little strange was you see a lot of parents kind of reflexively saying, I'm such a bad mom. Like, I feel so guilty, but I do it anyway. And I feel like that kind of talk is a way of putting up barriers where you might feel that you need to change, but you don't really want to change yet. And so what I'm hoping to do with this book is to get people to pass that and say, you know, we're all bad parents in some ways, but we can all do better. And that's really where we need to go.
I remember when my kids were in the middle school ages and just looking and asking to get these different apps, there was like this network of parents talking to each other. Well, have you let them try this yet? And do you forbid this one? And sometimes it was just helpful to know that other people were struggling with the same question.
That's really, really true. And I'm very excited to see the kinds of conversations that are coming out, you know, with this book and around this book and on Facebook and other places. Because the more we talk about our kids' use of media, the better chance we'll have, you know, to intervene or to see trouble spots. A dad told me a story on the road in Seattle about, you know, it wasn't his kid, but it was a friend of his kid who was having a problematic relationship with social media and posting things that were really upsetting. And his, you know, that kid's parents had no idea, but by virtue of the fact that he told his peers, that parent had a chance to intervene. And so, it does take a village, right? And we need that kind of support network, and we need to have an open dialogue.
Are we leaving too much in the hands of families, which is to say, do the creators of these devices and the content that goes on them have any responsibility for producing things that can be used in an appropriate way without a lot of intervention?
That's a live debate that's happening right now. We are starting to look at the platform makers and the device makers collectively as a society. And you see that with shareholders. There's an Apple shareholders meeting coming up, and this is questions been raised about the iPhone. The Center for Humane Technology came out with a big event last week talking about, you know, how these devices and how these platforms are really, designed for addiction or at least compulsive use. And so, yeah, I mean, I think parents have always been a very strong voice for ethics in the way that, you know, we conduct ourselves as a society, whether that's Mothers Against Drunk Driving or whether that's tobacco campaigns. And I think that there's an opening for parents now to say, gosh, you know, if the parents with the most income and the most resources, the most education are still stymied, you know, what about that kid who doesn't have the optimal, supervision, or their parents are just completely overwhelmed for other reasons? Can't we make technology that's a little bit safer for people to use?
Any new rules in your house since you started this project?
So my daughter's rule, my older daughter is screens on Saturdays are cool, and then we have passes for the week for iPads. But the new rules are for mom and dad. The new rules for us are no phones in the bedroom, and like I mentioned before, narrate what you're doing when you pick up your phone around your kids. I also turned off all the notifications on my phone, so I don't get a push notification. I have to look to the phone to see what's happening.
What do you think your children will have to worry about? What technologies will be on their plate to deal with when they're raising their own kids?
Oh, my gosh. Well, during the course of this book, you know, the home device, the AI assistant that you converse
Google
with.
Google Home
Echo, Alexa, Google Home has suddenly become a commonplace thing. So our kids' relationship with bots is something we need to negotiate. We need to worry about virtual reality, augmented reality. You know, is it screen time when Elmo comes off the screen and he's existing in 3D space alongside your kid? That's happening, that we're getting there. So, you know, figuring out what a balanced approach means when it's no longer about a screen, but it's actually just about digital media in the 3D.
Anya Kamenetz covers education for NPR and is author of a new book called The Art of Screen Time, How Your Family Can Balance Digital Media and Real Life. Anya, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for making time for us.
Oh, thank you so much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. The Twitter handle is @KERAThink. Mine is @ChrisBoydThink. You can subscribe to the podcast anywhere you find podcasts. You can also find archives of the Think Show and information about what we have coming up at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.